We know the effects of globalization by vivid anecdote. When a disease like SARS hopscotches from China to Toronto in a matter of weeks, when a computer crash in Minneapolis is resolved by a software technician in Bangalore, India, when Egyptians buy McFalafel, or when Americans eat roast beef sandwiches with wasabi mayonnaise. It sometimes seems as if we can feel the world getting smaller and more interconnected, but how small exactly, and how fast? Measuring this huge, dynamic, and complex phenomenon is a challenge that's been embraced by Foreign Policy magazine. They've published the fourth annual A.T. Kearney Foreign Policy Globalization Index. This year it measured various factors in 62 countries to see just how global a country is and how it compares with others. For the third year in a row, Ireland is number one. But what exactly is globalization? What are they measuring, and how are they measuring it, and what does it tell us about the effects of globalization? So where do you think the U.S. or Canada or China falls on the global index, and how do you define globalization? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Two people who've worked on this index join us now. Mark Strauss is senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine, editor of the Index, and he joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
And Paul Laudisina is with A.T. Kearney, the global managing consultant firm that assembled this index. He's the managing director of their Global Business Policy Council, and he joins us from NPR's Bureau in Chicago, and good to have you on the show.
Thanks very much, Neil.
So when you started out to measure globalization, how did you define it? And I guess, Mark, the impetus came from you guys.
Well, it was actually a joint project, and we both realized that people tend to frequently think of globalization strictly in economic terms, and we wanted to illustrate how other factors play an important role.
Such as?
Well, we wanted to move beyond trade investment and look at these other drivers. So beyond economics, we also looked at technological, where we measure users of the World Wide Web and the number of internet hosts. We look at personal contact, which is international travel, tourism, telephone traffic. And finally, we look at political engagement, where we look at issues like membership in international organizations, ratification of select international treaties, contributions to UN peacekeeping missions, and also levels of foreign aid.
And Paul Laudisina, how do you boil that all down into one number?
Well, obviously, it's a complex mix of a number of variables that we measure across all of these 62 countries that account for 84% of the world's population and 96% of the world's economic output. And we come up with a composite score that constitutes how globalized the country is.
There are things I know, Mark, that you think are these are all very difficult things to figure out. Culture, for example, is hard to measure.
Yeah, it's devilishly difficult to measure culture for two reasons. One, there isn't a lot of data on the trade and cultural products, such as movies and music. But the other thing
is... we see those figures on how much money Hollywood movies make overseas.
But, you know, we don't know how many of those films, the level that they are sent all around the world. You know, we want to measure as many countries as possible. Another aspect is, how do you measure culture? How do you measure something as intangible as an idea? And, you know, I always say that if there was a way to sort of break culture into a statistic, you know, Japan would probably see its score go up. You know, it's known as the Pokemon hegemon because it has this huge influence worldwide on our popular culture. You can see that every day, but, you know, how do you measure that? And it's very difficult. So that's one thing that we've never been able to quite get a bead on.
And Paul, are you measuring these incoming and outgoing?
Yes, absolutely. We're measuring the movement of people, for example, into and out of a country. We're measuring telephone traffic across borders. We're measuring capital that moves across borders. All of these to show what kind of dynamic their relationship is between a given country and those beyond that border.
Now, I think, Mark, we want to establish, first of all, that you don't claim that this is a perfect measure by any stretch of the imagination.
No, but by no stretch of the imagination, but we like to think of it as a very good guesstimate, or at least the best one that we think anyone else has been able to come up with.
And in terms of talking about globalization, the idea of this was at least to establish, if an imperfect baseline, some agreed set of statistics that we can all talk about globalization from.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to evaluate globalization unless you can actually measure it. I mean, how else do you determine whether globalization, for instance, is accelerating or slowing down? how else can you figure out which countries and regions are most connected to the rest of the world? When we say more globalized countries are like this, less globalized countries are like that, how can you say these things, unless you have at least some kind of guesstimate as to how globalized said country actually is?
And we'll get to that in just a second. But Paul Laudisina, can you tell us a little bit about pace? You've been measuring this for 4 years now. Is globalization accelerating as it seems as if it is?
Well, curiously enough, conventional wisdom might have suggested that with the downturn in global economic activity in 2001-2002, that globalization, in fact, would have slowed down. But indeed, we see the pace of globalization continuing to move ahead quickly, and it's moving ahead quickly as much because of technological, social, and political integration as it is economic integration. So this is why we look at all four of these drivers, and as you suggested, this isn't to assume that we have exhausted all of the components of globalization, but we're trying to measure those components of globalization for which there's a broad enough, reliable enough database across as many countries as possible in the world, and that's how we've come up with these findings.
Mark, are you trying to answer the question of whether globalization is on measure a good thing or a bad thing?
No, we're trying not to make any value judgments about globalization being good or bad. What we're doing is just simply providing, as you said, a baseline evaluations that people can sort of discuss, debate, and draw their own conclusions.
Well, Paul, let's end the suspense. We've already mentioned that Ireland is the surprise number one ranking in most globalized country. In what ways?
Well, Ireland has been, for the third year in a row, the most global country in this index, with trade and foreign direct investment into Ireland beating global trends, even though its lead over other countries have declined. And I think all of the criteria that one looks at, Ireland does extremely well, certainly in terms of movement of people across borders, in terms of telephone traffic, in terms of political integration, in terms of technological connectivity. I mean, visitors, for example, to the Emerald Isle numbered 6.5 million in 2002. That's three visitors for every two residents. Remittances were up. Overall personal contact, Ireland came in second in the world, but on the strength of its strong showing in terms of economic integration combined with personal and social integration, Ireland has done extremely well, and so they lead the index again.
And Mark, as we look at different kinds of countries, it tends to be the smaller economies, smaller industrialized economies,
yes,
that are the most globalized.
Mm-hmm. And I think, there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that larger countries, by the virtue of the size of their economies, can draw more on their internal resources and don't have to go out to the rest of the world the way some of these smaller countries have to do. And also, in order to gauge sort of the full impact, many of these numbers are looked at in relative to overall gross domestic product and sometimes population size, to give you a better, sense of just how deeply integrated the individual countries are. So smaller countries, for those reasons, do tend to measure highly.
And you basically come down to the idea, as I understand it, Paul, that there are two regions in the world that are seemingly wired for globalization much better than other regions in the world. And if you had to pick those two out, it would be Scandinavia and North America.
That's right. Clearly, by all of the indices, secure servers per capita, the number of connections to the Internet, all of the indicators that we look at for technological connectivity, the United States and Scandinavia do the best on this index.
We're talking about globalization. So how do you define globalization? What do you think its effects are around the world and how to measure them? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Trevor, who joins us on the phone from Odessa, Texas.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
I was just wondering if you guys had considered McLuhan's notion of the global village, that the increase in communication technologies and media will eventually lead to one global culture and kind of the destruction of individual cultures.
The homogenization of culture. Is that something you took into account, Mark?
Well, it's something, of course, because we can't measure, as we said, culture. It's something that's difficult to reflect in the index. We do try to reflect you know, the connectivity, of course, you know, through the internet, and the kind of, and that's a very important issue. My own personal take is that we don't see cultural homogenization as much as we see what's known as glocalization, which is that we have basically cultures take what they like and they adapt it to their own national cultures. An example, of course, is MTV in India. MTV is very much a global music service, but if you watch MTV in India, it's very different than MTV as in the United States. It focuses on different music, different celebrities.
Or the aforementioned McFalafel.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, Trevor, were you a fan of McLuhan's?
Well, I'm a communication major, so I have to be.
So you have to be. Well, have a good time with him.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Neil, if I can interject on that question, it's a good question, and it's actually one of the paradoxes of globalization. It wasn't so many years ago that everyone thought with the advent of the internet that there'd be complete homogenization of culture. And in fact, what we've seen is the effervescence of local cultures, linguistic groups, affinity groups of all kinds, because the internet makes it possible for people to communicate with others who share language, who share ethnicity, who share an interest in culture, and therefore, in fact, the internet and information technology has allowed for the effervescence of local culture in many ways.
Let's get another caller on the line. Chris is with us from San Antonio, Texas.
Yes, I was just wondering, in terms of measuring all that, aren't economic and business tables of a great value? Isn't that just sort of proportionate in some ways to cultural influence? And the other thing, as far as that goes, as far as when it's safe for international commerce and open borders, certainly that's the ultimate goal of everybody. But when it's difficult to trade, as it might be now because of this terrorist business, doesn't that directly degrade the spreading of culture and globalization and economic activity?
Paul Laudisina, do you want to tackle that?
Sure. There's no question but that economic integration is an extraordinarily important driver of globalization. That's why we measure international trade in goods and services and portfolio capital flows, foreign direct investment, and international investment income payments. But it is also true as well that with the kinds of interruptions to integration that terrorism has provided, we see some downturns in tourism activity for the first year. For example, in 2001, we saw a decline in tourism activity the first year since the World Tourism Association was monitoring tourism flows across borders. So those tend to have a negative impact on integration. But as we said at the start of the hour, this index demonstrates that even in the midst of contraction in economic integration and to some extent personal contact, with the huge explosion in technological connectivity as well as additional and enhanced political engagement, we actually see globalization scores going up in spite of the hiccup in economic and personal integration.
Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you. That's very interesting.
Oh, good call. There are any number of factors, aren't there, Mark, that indicate might help be predictive of whether a country is going to rank high or low on the globalization scale in addition to something like security.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, and like I say, is that, you know, that's why we break down. What we're sort of doing is reverse engineering global integration for countries and looking at, you know, these different factors like the level of tourism, the amount of international telephone traffic. And what Paul had mentioned before about technology being sort of a driver underlying all this is quite important. I think one point is that in this latest version of our index, international telephone traffic grew by 9 billion minutes. But for the first time in history, the number of mobile phones per capita worldwide has exceeded fixed telephone lines. What you're seeing is the developing countries basically leaping over this fixed infrastructure and becoming more connected through this technology.
Interesting. We're talking with two editors of the annual Globalization Index in Foreign Policy magazine. Do you see signs of globalization when you travel? We're taking your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about a definition of globalization and rankings of countries about it. Our guests are Mark Strauss, senior editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, and Paul Laudisina of the global managing consulting firm A.T. Kearney. So how global are you? Are you a business person who considers globalization when you choose a country to do business in or sell your product? You're invited to join us. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. Roberta's with us from San Francisco.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Great show.
Thank you.
My question is with regard to who are the poorest, the least affluent on the scale, and what can be done to maybe correct that or rectify it? Or
well, that's a question. Are the least globalized, Mark, the most poverty stricken?
Well, just tell you what the bottom 10 very quickly. We have Brazil, Kenya, Turkey, Bangladesh, China, Venezuela, Indonesia, Egypt, India, and Iran. These are at the bottom of the index. And
Didn't measure North Korea.
No, it didn't measure North Korea.
Okay.
I don't think they have as many statistics as we would like. And one thing we noticed, I mean, these countries, although they're from very diverse regions, share common problems. Countries that are heavily dependent on oil exports, for instance, like oil in Venezuela, are subject to the whims of the international energy market. Countries, for instance, that also have persistent political unrest or corruption, such as Venezuela, Bangladesh, and Indonesia, could discourage foreign investment and tourism. So, I mean, there are multiple reasons that come together to explain.
China's a curiosity, though, because China, it seems, is out manufacturing every other country in the world at the moment.
Well, China, actually, again, there's that sort of, issue with larger countries in the sense that larger countries can draw upon internal resources.
And their economies are so diverse.
But it ranks higher than the United States on our index this year in terms of economic integration due to, for instance, large amounts of foreign investment. But if you look at other issues such as technological connectivity and the internet compared to these other countries, it's very weak in those terms and also very weak in terms of political engagement compared with other countries in the world. Japan is a country, for instance, which is much more politically engaged.
And you point out that, for example, one thing you measure is how many foreign periodicals are available to the citizenry, and in China, very few.
I mean, that's certainly one aspect, aspect of it. So.
Yeah. Paul Laudisina, how do you gauge which of these is more important than the other? How do you assign monetary values to each of these different indicators?
Well, we certainly think that the economic indicators are among the most important indicators, because if a country is not economically advancing and economically connected to the rest of the world, it's very hard for them to be making the kinds of investment in technological connectivity or providing for the citizenry to be able to talk or move across borders. So clearly economics is an important driver. It is, however, important to note as well that when you look at the least globalized countries, they also tend to have the least equal income distribution. They tend to have the least civil liberties and political rights. They tend to have the least advanced life expectancies. So there seems to be a positive association between those countries that are globalized or globalizing rapidly and those countries that do better across all of the other quality of life indices that we measure.
Well, Mark, that raises the question about these low-ranking countries. Are they poor and unequal because they are not globalized or too globalized? I mean, is it chicken and the egg here?
Yeah, I mean, and it's always hard, to guess what you said with chicken and egg. You're looking at this issue of causation and correlation. I mean, I think, though, if there's one thing that you can walk away with is that countries that are globalized, that are integrated into the global economy, tend to do better economically. The broader question, though, is to what extent is that wealth being shared, throughout a country, and to what extent is income inequality in a country decreasing and increasing?
Do you see any surprises on that list? I mean, you would think that the countries that got the economic head start, if you will, the industrialized countries of the first world, Paul Laudisina, would be the most globalized and most interconnected and most prosperous, but do you see any surprising, mid-range countries that jump up?
Well, I guess the closer you get to the data, the less surprising it seems. The United States moved up in the data 4 places from where it was last year, moving into the top 10 for the first time this year. And that despite the fact that we saw the economic downturn that we did in 2002, which was the statistical basis that we were measuring for the release of this year's statistics.
Mm-hmm.
But it's largely because of the technological driver, that the U.S. had the highest number of Internet users in a single country, 155 million compared to the 59 million in second place China. We had certainly more Internet hosts. The U.S. had 12 and a half times as many hosts as Japan. We had 10 times as many secure servers as the United Kingdom. So technologically, the United States moved ahead quite smartly and therefore moved up in the rankings overall. And I think that's one of the indicators that we found most interesting this year.
Well, let's get another caller. Austin is with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out that I'm a sophomore at a university here in St. Louis, and being 19, I've been in sort of an internet economy my entire life, or most of my life that I can remember. And globalization is just, I mean, we accept it as the norm. It's nothing unusual. I think I probably had three professors from other countries. I mean, probably 20% of my university is from another country. As a computer science major, I do freelance work over the internet. Really just for whoever wants to hire me. And I've done work for people in the United Kingdom, Australia. I've even outsourced work that has been outsourced to Bangalore. So, I mean, to people my age, it's just not a big deal anymore. We're used to it. We know what it's about, and we deal with it.
As you look at demographics, is that part of this mix at all, Mark Strauss? He's talking about young people being so savvy about this and accepting of it. Is age of a population a factor in globalization?
Well, it's a factor for me because you just made me feel very, very old. Because I'm not quite 40 yet, and I've not lived the internet all my life. But I do appreciate how obviously people are taking into it more. But more of the point, we have this issue. What's going to be key to countries reaping the benefits of globalization, particularly some of these countries in emerging markets, developing world, is whether their governments are going to be able to provide them with the opportunities to develop the skills that are needed to embrace and work with these new technologies. You have to look at certain level of domestic education and job training in various nations.
Is there a correlation between political freedom and globalization? Paul, why don't you try that?
Sure. Yes, there is, in fact. We measured the results of the Globalization Index against the Freedom House Civil Liberties Index that looks at civil liberties and political rights. And clearly, the countries that are more globalized tend to be countries that also have a greater orientation towards civil liberties and political rights.
Austin, thanks very much for the call, and good luck with the rest of your career.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. We all appreciate many of the good effects of globalization. It's nice to be able to go rent a foreign movie down at your local video store. But there is a considerable backlash, Mark Strauss. Why do you think that is?
I think two key reasons. One is something we discussed before, inequality, and that is that there are people who are being shut out of the benefits of globalization, and they can see it very visibly, through our interconnected world, that they are not participating in such.
So they can turn on that television and see that people elsewhere are
exactly.
Living a much better life than they are.
And I think the other issue is, how should I put it, it's a heightened level of anxiety, a sense that people are losing control over their own lives. The idea that a government half a world away or an international organization like the World Trade Organization can make decisions that affect their lives and they really don't have any say in the matter, I think that's also a big part of it.
Paul Laudicina, globalization is a fact, and your index seeks to measure it, not to answer the question of whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But as you look at the data and what's come out in your 4 years of analysis, have you come to the conclusion about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think, yes, absolutely, Neil. We have begun this without any preconceived notions about which countries will fall where and whether or not this net impact is good or bad. But we take the globalization scores and then we measure those countries against other indices, like indices of income distribution or civil liberties that we already talked about or corruption in government as well as looking at it against life expectancy, educational attainment, all of the things that go into the so-called UN Human Development Index. And without a question, those countries that are more globalized tend to be those countries that have better economic growth, more equal income distribution, more civil liberties and political rights, more clean government, longer life expectancies, better treatment of women, better environmental standards across the board. And that's true also not just between the top of the globalization list and the bottom, but also within groups of countries, even those countries that are less globalized. Those among the less globalized countries that are more globalized tend to have a better attainment in each of these areas than their peers that lag behind.
Let's get another caller in. This is Krutara, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hey, hi.
Hi.
My comment was like you were talking about globalization, and what I was thinking is globalization is basically, it's not just the corporations and the governments interacting in a way. It's how people interact with each other, as well as how they take the technology that they have in their existing world or their cultures and taking it to another different country or a different region and letting people know this is what we have, this is what is good, and this is what is bad. So that's what it is about. It's not just something that just a corporation would come and tell you that this is what I have and this is good or this is bad.
Krutara, can I ask where you're from originally?
I'm from India originally.
And I wonder, do you send money back to your folks back home?
Yeah, a little bit. But my parents are doctors, so they don't need that much money.
And you went to school in India, or did you come here to go to school?
No, I did my undergraduate in India, then I did some of my graduate work here in United States, too.
And in this world today, where among the globalizing effects is that you can get on a plane and be back home in, about 20 very wrenching hours, that makes a difference when you're thinking about moving across the world, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But that's where the technology comes into play, is like how I use my technology where I am right now to interact with the folks back home. As well as if I was in India, how would I have used the same technology, what was available in India, in what form, to interact with the rest of the people? And that's what makes what globalization is. It's like how you best use the technology to forward yourself as well as the growth of the whole country. So,
well, good luck, Krutara.
Uh-huh.
Thanks for the phone call.
Thanks very much.
Here's an email we got from Sue in Portland, Oregon. As a British subject, I'm beginning to come to the conclusion that my family is a global family that's part of a global workforce. My husband and I moved from Wales in the UK to Munich in Germany, where we had two children. From there, we moved to Chicago, Illinois, where we had another child. Our next move was to Portland, Oregon. As the result of the economy, my husband has been laid off from two jobs. He's now working in Perth, Australia. It's possible that our family may move there, too. Two of our children are British subjects. One is a U.S. citizen. My husband's bachelor's degree was from the U.K. His master's from Portland State University. I'm working on my B.S., which I may have to finish in Australia. Mark Strauss, like Krutara, these people are defining the future, aren't they?
Absolutely. And one thing which also comes up is that, you know, it's harder to know sometimes national identity is blurring in more and more. I mean, although we talked about globalization earlier, for instance, a BMW produced in the United States, built by a German company, produced by American workers. I mean, is that a German car? Is it an American car? I mean, you tell me.
How do you measure local
exactly.
Content and something like that? We're talking about globalization with Mark Strauss and Paul Laudacina. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's another caller. Sarah is with us from Palo Alto, California.
How do you do? Neil, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Globalization is not just countries competing against countries. There's a University of Chicago scholar named Saskia Sassen who's written quite a lot about metro areas competing with metro areas. For example, Silicon Valley with Bangalore and Hsinchu Park in Taiwan. But a lot of these national level and international level data don't show much about regions competing with regions. I think Mark said a moment ago that the broader question is how the extent to which the wealth created by globalization is shared.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if Paul and Mark could comment on what types of data they could not find, but they would like to to be able to rely upon that would indicate what's going on at the subnational level, what types of differential impacts globalization has on metro areas or subnational regions.
Paul Laudisina?
Well, it's a very good question, and it is one of the deficiencies of measuring trans-border or, I should say, activities which transcend borders, but doing it in the context of nation-states, because the way statistics are generated these days, they're generated on the basis of nation-states. So it's a limiting factor that you have to actually define your statistical base within a border to be able to look at how it refers or references you to trans-border phenomena. But we know for a fact, as the caller Sarah points out, that there is a lot of activity cross borders. For example, New England in the United States in many ways has a greater affinity with the maritime provinces in Canada than they do with Western Canada, and Pacific Canada may have more in common with California than California does with Washington. So there's a lot of those kinds of regional relationships, and unfortunately the statistics does not allow us to track those relationships except anecdotally. And I would say if you took it each of the criteria and you were able to provide accurate data for those criteria based on regional phenomena rather than national phenomenon, we would probably have a much more robust index.
Sarah, good question. I guess she hung up to listen to the answer. I appreciate the phone call. Let's go to Max, and Max is with us from Petaluma, California.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question was that your guests have correlated the globalization index with a number of other quality of life indices, human rights and whatnot. I was wondering if they had correlated it with economic or, I mean, environmental impacts, such as the indice that was discussed on the Pulse of the Planet the other day, and environmental footprint and other indices.
Mark Strauss, is that a factor?
We did actually, in a previous iteration of the index, actually, I believe it was last year, looked at sort of a correlation between how globalized a country is and how much it is committed to defending the environment. And we actually did find as well that countries that are more globally integrated tend to be environmentally greener countries in terms of environmental policies they pursue.
That's interesting, because I think, especially among a lot of the folks who protest against the WTO and other things, there's a perception, and one that I had, that oftentimes globalization entails a run to the lowest common denominator in terms of environmental standards and other economic motivators.
Get a quick response, Mark?
Well, I think, I mean, it's very difficult to summarize, but one point I think is, for instance, when companies operate in emerging markets, they bring with them sometimes cleaner technologies, and also developing countries are developing their own standards.
Max, thanks very much for the call, and I'd like to thank both of our guests, Mark Strauss, senior editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, with us here in Studio 3A, and Paul Laudisina, managing director of A.T. Kearney's Global Business Policy Council, with us from our bureau in Chicago. When we come back, popularization instead of globalization. This is NPR News.